At least a dozen times during his quest, Frodo chooses to follow his heart over his calculating reason and his experience, and most of the time, the choice turns out to be crucially right.
On many occasions in Lord of the Rings, the Fellowship, especially Frodo and Sam, have to make choices that are not merely moral choices between known good and known evil, but epistemological choices between wisdom and folly, reality and appearance, and choosing between two apparent goods or two apparent evils, especially what to do with the ring. The question of whom to trust frequently arises. For instance, how did Frodo know Strider was trustworthy when he first met him in Bree? How to know when to mete out justice and when to give mercy is another epistemological question, as well as a moral question. Neither Frodo nor Gandalf knew the role Gollum was destined to play, yet Gandalf says, "My heart tells me he has some role to play yet, for good or ill, before the end." How did Gandalf know this? He did not know the future. He was not a prophet. In terms of C.S. Lewis's The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, he knew it because he knew the deeper magic from before the dawn of time. All right, Clifford, back again, another one.
Indeed we are, kicking off book four. Still the Two Towers.
Yep,
book
yep,
two
yep.
of book two, you could say. But we've got today The Taming of Sméagol, chapter one.
Okay, so today we're going to go over, we'll set the stage what Frodo and Sam have been doing, because we haven't seen them in 11 chapters. What's next? They go down a cliff. That was kind of cool. We'll briefly talk about that. Probably extend it by accident. And then they meet Gollum. So that's going to be a whole incident. Lots to talk about there. Pretty good start to this book, if you ask me. But before all that, Cliff's notes.
So we turn back the clock to find Frodo and Sam shortly after they canoed across the Anduin. They're making slow, repetitive progress through the lifeless hills of Emmonweal, trying to find a way eastward, but frequently getting lost. They finally come to the edge of the hills, but can't find any way down that doesn't require climbing down cliff faces. But thankfully, they come prepared. After making it down, they realize that they are being pursued by Gollum. In the dark, they manage to capture Gollum, who eventually swears on the ring to serve Frodo and to help them find a path across the dead marshes to the Gate of Mordor.
Okay, cool. Thoughts on the chapter? Feelings?
Immediately, well, I don't want to be rude to Sam and Frodo, but less fun than what we've been dealing with, I think. the mood starts out just so much bleaker. They're like stuck. They're stuck in a rut from the outset, and the whole chapter is like basically them making progress in the rut that they're stuck in, is how I felt.
Yeah, well, you know, there is still, we're going to get into it in a second here, but there's still a bunch of land descriptions, but this time it's not like pretty awesome fields in Rohan. It's bleak, creepy, slimy rock.
Right, you know, right. The last book we had these beautiful grasslands, like you say, luscious forests, like snow-capped mountain peaks.
The caves.
Yeah. So many beautiful things in the last book that people were just in awe over. And now we've got just death.
Decay.
Uh-huh.
All right, so like you did you say this? Anyways, it's 3 days since they left the Fellowship at this point. And so they're in this Emmonweal, which was that, you know, the rocks near the Rauros, the waterfall. And it's kind of mazy. They're having a hard time finding their way out. And Frodo's kind of antsy because he thinks they're losing time. So 3 days after the Fellowship, I think at this point, Merry and Pippin just escaped or are about to escape from the orcs, I think, right? And so Legolas
that sounds right.
Aragorn, Legolas, and Gimli are running behind. Now, all right, just to anybody that, like, sorry I'm not confident in this, and I know I could just flip to the appendix where, like, the dates are given and stuff, but I don't know. I guess we're loosely trying to just do this without having to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. But anyways, why don't we just take this first section here, because I have a surprisingly lot to say about it.
The Hobbit stood now on the brink of a tall cliff, bare and bleak, its feet wrapped in mist, and behind them rose the broken highlands, crowned with drifting cloud. A chill wind blew from the east. Night was gathering over the shapeless lands before them. The sickly green of them was fading to a sullen brown. Far away to the right, the Anduin, that had gleamed fitfully in sunbreaks during the day, was now hidden in shadow. But their eyes did not look beyond the river, back to Gondor, to their friends, to the lands of men. South and east they stared to where, at the edge of the oncoming night, a dark line hung, like distant mountains of motionless smoke. Every now and again a tiny red gleam far away flickered upwards on the rim of earth and sky.
What a fix, said Sam. That's one place in all the lands we've ever heard of that we don't want to see any closer, and that's the one place we're trying to get to. And that's just where we can't get, no how. We've come the wrong way altogether, seemingly. We can't get down, and if we get down, we'd find all that green land a nasty bog, I'll warrant. Phew, can you smell it? He sniffed at the wind.
Yes, I can smell it, said Frodo, but he did not move, and his eyes remained fixed, staring out towards the dark line and the flickering flame. Mordor, he muttered under his breath. If I must go there, I wish I could come there quickly and make an end. He shuddered. The wind was chilly and yet heavy with an odor of cold decay. Well, he said, at last withdrawing his eyes, we cannot stay here all night, fix or no fix. We must find a more sheltered spot and camp once more. And perhaps another day will show us a path.
Or another and another and another, muttered Sam. Or maybe no day. We've come the wrong way.
I wonder, said Frodo. It's my doom, I think, to go to that shadow yonder, so that a way will be found. But will good or evil show it to me? What hope we had was in speed. Delay plays into the enemy's hands, and here I am, delayed. Is it the will of the Dark Tower that steers us? All my choices have proved ill. I should have left the company long before, and come down from the north, east of the river and of Emmonweal, so over the heart of the battle plain to the passes of Mordor. But now it isn't possible for you and me alone to find a way back. And the orcs are prowling on the east bank. Every day that passes is a precious day lost. I'm tired, Sam. I don't know what is to be done. What food have we got left?
Only those what-do-you-call-ems. Lembas, Mr. Frodo. A fair supply, but they are better than naught by a long bite. I never thought, though, when I first set tooth in them, that I should ever come to wish for a change. But I do now. A bit of plain bread and a mug, aye, half a mug, of beer would go down proper. I've lugged my cooking gear all the way from the last camp, and what use has it been? Not to make a fire with, for a start, and not to cook. Not even grass. Alright, your initial thoughts?
I mean, this kind of sums up the chapter, I should say, right?
Yeah, at least the mood of the chapter.
Yeah, they're in a pinch, they know it, and I think they're talking each other through it and keeping each other's spirits up, but both of them are down. Even Sam, who's usually so upbeat and pragmatic, is just like, we're lost, we're running out of food, and I wish we weren't here.
Right, and Frodo feels a sense of, like, urgency. We gotta get through this, we gotta get to Mordor. So, before we forget, just, I think that passage highlighted the landscape pretty well. This is the east of the river versus the nicer west of the river that we were dealing with for the rest of the book, where the worst thing was kind of... Well, actually, the worst thing was definitely Isengard destroyed, but that was an evil place. So, whereas here, it's just pretty hopeless looking. It doesn't seem like it's going to get any better either.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, like you said at the beginning, compared to the Merry and Pippin recent chapters, I don't know, Frodo almost sounds depressed, and he almost sounds kind of like Shakespearean. You know, in my opinion, he sounds like some tragic hero or something. It's like, it's my doom to go to that shadow yonder, blah, 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 you know?
Yeah, exactly.
But who will show me the way, good or evil, you know? So, obviously he sounds overdramatic there, but remember, like, put it in context. This whole journey is going to suck, and he knows it, right?
Right.
And what he's saying there is, I'd rather just be over now, you know? And, like... Which doesn't anybody, like, wouldn't everybody in that situation just feel the same thing, you know? It's like, it must be, you know, must be tempting to just try to find some easier road or something, right?
And he's immediately regretful when he's reflecting at the end. He's thinking, it seems like I'm just doing everything wrong right now. Is it because I'm being swayed by this kind of the force that's trying to control me? Or am I just making bad decisions?
Yeah, it's that one line. So the all my choices have proved ill. I should have left the company long before. What does that sound like that we've already read in this book? All right, I guess I'll give the hint. It's somewhere in Two Towers already.
Well, debates about path or course. I mean, we recall from... No, okay.
No, you're on the right track. That's, you basically got it. Just say that.
Hold on, I gotta think about it for a second, though. It sounds like Gandalf perhaps riding for Gondor or trying to decide what his next move is.
No. Go further back. Further back.
Okay. It's in Two Towers. The first thing I thought of that's pre Two Towers is the Fellowship debating their course of action.
Okay, that works too. That
Aragorn fits, wanted to go one way, Boromir another, and then even just going over the mountain, Aragorn and Gandalf had different routes in mind.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking specifically of Aragorn being torn and wanting to go to Gondor to reclaim his throne with Boromir, who really wanted to go there, and then wanted to go east with Frodo. And Frodo got kind of pulled along. The whole company went until the very last point at which they could split to choose east or west. But they could have split sooner.
Right. I think the closest point is kind of in Book 3, Chapter 1, Aragorn, he's seeing Boromir's dead, and he's freaking out, and he doesn't know which way the hobbits all went, and he can't tell if they're separated or not. And he basically, I think he's got like the line, "All I do goes amiss today." You know, like, what's going on here, right? So that kind of sounds like Frodo. So again, we saw it kind of like almost every other chapter in Book 3, they're jumping around the story, you know, the threads, combining the threads together to make a saga, right? The Icelandic words, patter and pather, whatever. So just because this quote's funny, I think I already read this, but I'll read it again. Obviously, we're doing that now at the beginning of Book 4 in the most dramatic way because we're coming back to Frodo and Sam, who we haven't seen for literally an entire book and half of a physical book, right? And so Tolkien, Tom Shippey had the line in one of his books. He says, "One might feel that a more experienced writer, one who wrote novels or fantasies professionally rather than passionately, would have known not to risk such finesses or trust to so much to the ingenuity of his readers. But Tolkien knew no better than to try it." So to add on to this conversation that we've, because we've basically highlighted any time that they're switching storylines and everything, right, in the last book. To add on to that conversation, Shippey goes on and he says, "The main effect of this interlacing technique, however, does not lie in surprise or suspense. What it does is to create a profound sense of reality, of that being the way things are. There is a pattern in Tolkien's story, but his characters can never see it, naturally, because they're in it. To them, the whole story seems chaotic, haunted by bad luck. They are lost in a wilderness metaphorically, as well as cartographically. Indeed, in a bewilderment. Aragorn says, everything I do goes amiss." What do you think of that so far?
I'm a little bit confused. The first part of what you were saying about Tolkien leaving the bit to his readers.
Oh, sorry. Well, the first part, that's just tying all these stories together. It could get really confusing and tangled up and stuff. So,
right.
You know, Shippey was basically saying, like, bold move on Tolkien's part. Most people would just, you know, streamline this story and they wouldn't really try this. But Tolkien didn't know any better, so he was going to go for it.
Okay.
And again, like what I was saying in the second part here, that's the point. Part of the point of it is it seems very confusing for the characters, but for us, we understand what's going on there and we're supposed to get more out of it than just a surprise part where like, whoa, a forest shows up at Helm's Deep. You know, there's more to it than just making the plot exciting.
Right. I guess I feel like it's we're more omniscient than any of the characters, but we are not fully omniscient in the story, right?
Right.
Is that kind of what you're getting at?
Well, so we know that Aragorn says, "Oh man, everything I do goes amiss," and then we hear Frodo here say, "All my choices have proved ill." You know, I mean, very similar phrases at a similar point in the book. You know, they're both at the beginning of each respective book and stuff. So we should definitely see a parallel there. You know, Shippey goes on. He says, "Aragorn and Frodo have apparent good grounds to despair, but as chance would have it, There are things in the web of the story to refute those grounds. Gandalf points out, all Sauron and Saruman have done is bring Merry and Pippin in the nick of time to Fangorn, where they otherwise would never have come. So Frodo himself, he should take heart from this example, but he can't because he's writing it and he doesn't know what's going on with his friends. But we as readers can. And, you know, this seeing these kinds of things, it's like that should inspire us, you know, and this is why we read the story and this is why this is awesome, you know. And we should go on with our task. And now, since we saw the other characters, we should hope and root that Frodo and Sam go on as well.
Okay, okay.
The other cool part to this, too, that Shippy points out, he says, you know, if you think about it, what we saw in the third book, Saruman's treachery, that was not a good thing, right? You know, it would have been helpful if he had never turned. It would have been better if he was just a good guy the whole time. Right. That said, Aragorn, like kind of almost conversely, Aragorn, he chased down Merry and Pippin, but presumably if he didn't chase them down, Merry and Pippin still would have come to Fangorn and still would have roused the Ents and attacked Isengard. So did Aragorn really have to chase him down? These are kind of just like what ifs about the third book. Like, would this all have come through? And so Shippy says, he's got two quotes here. He says, what one can absolutely be sure about is that giving up does the other side's work for them and ruins all your own possible futures and other people's as well. Okay? Does that make sense?
You miss every shot you don't take.
Right. Yeah. And then he also says, too, he adds, while persistence offers no guarantees, it does give luck a chance to operate through unknown allies or unknown weaknesses in the opposition. Reading that kind of stuff, it's just, this is what makes Lord of the Rings awesome. This is the kind of reason why everybody should read stories like this, you know? Stories like this, they should have messages like that. Any thoughts?
I mean, yeah, I agree. It's inspiring, yeah. I guess.
Yeah. I don't think other books do this. You know, I guess I always pick on this one, but Game of Thrones, you know, that guy just weaves that story all together, and I don't think it has as great a point as this, you know, because he weaves the story together to prove that point, and I don't think that goes on in Game of Thrones. I think the guy just got above his head, over his head, just because he wanted to tell an intricate story that was, you know, exciting.
He's shaping the story, but maybe he's not shaping the experience of the reader. Is what you're saying?
Yeah, or there's no bigger takeaway besides just to entertain.
Okay. Okay.
All right, remember the eyes from book two? When they were floating down the river, they kept seeing the eyes. They concluded that it was Gollum, right?
Paddling on a log, right? Something like that.
Right. So I don't think they've seen him since. So they're hoping that they shook him from his trail for good. But who knows? But then what does Frodo say there?
So do I, said Frodo. But he's not my chief trouble. I wish we could get away from these hills. I hate them. I feel all naked on the east side, stuck up here with nothing but the dead flats between me and that shadow yonder. There's an eye in it. Come on, we've got to get down today somehow.
Okay, so again, Frodo's got lots more urgency. Kind of creepy that he can...
Yeah, he feels like, exposed. Okay, Gollum is following us, but the eye of Sauron is watching me, and that makes me feel way worse, right?
Yeah. Okay, all right, so they wander all day, and they seem to be making some sort of progress down, and then they find this gully/ravine thing. Those are the same, right? Gully and ravine? I think he used the word
gully. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. All right. Yeah. Anyways, it brings them a good way down, but then they still come to the edge of some sort of cliff. It doesn't seem like it's completely vertical cliff, but it's like, you know, if a cliff's 90 degrees, it's like probably 85 or 80.
Right.
To get down.
Pretty sure.
But it looks, it looks pretty climbable though, like, you know, handholds and slight ledges for them. Now, this ordeal, and it was an ordeal to get down this cliff, is something we're just going to leave for you guys to read yourselves. It's kind of suspenseful at parts, because there's this big storm that just starts right away, and then they hear the scream of a black rider who seems to have been in the air, and then somehow Frodo's kind of blind, or blinded, which I didn't quite understand, but we're just going to move on. It's also notable, Sam proves to be brave but also dumb, because he just kind of is about to just go for it with no climbing experience and no guidance or picking out anything, and Frodo calls mm-hmm. him an ass for it. And then, but
Sam,
of course,
Sam completely forgets that he's got a great length of elven rope in his backpack.
Yep. And this rope, of course, it's light. Of course, it's long. Of course, it's super milky smooth. And of course,
and
it's super
strong.
Tough. Yeah, right. Yeah. And to cap it all off, the awesome token detail. It'll untie itself when you want it to.
Dare we say a magic rope?
Oh, well, I mean, it's the elf's power, you know? It's,
right, right.
So, some elf, he was just born to make awesome rope like that. Mm-hmm. And he trained and he honed his skill to make the best stuff. All right, but the most important and real questions for you is, first of all, number one, and you better be able to rattle this off, do you remember what a fathom is? We've talked about it before.
Yes, I will admit I actually looked it up while reading this chapter because I had forgotten. But it's 2 yards, which means it's 6 feet. So
okay.
Makes you wonder why they came up with a different word for like something so similar. You know, like is it really that much easier to say 20
fathoms
versus
for water.
40 yards?
I think fathoms were for water. You couldn't stick
depth,
your yardstick in there because it would rust.
Oh, interesting. Specifically for depth versus length.
Yeah.
Okay. Which is why they would measure a cliff with depth, like they're plumbing the depth.
Something. Okay. Well, the other measurement here, an L, did you look that one up?
I didn't.
Oh, you didn't? Oh.
Help me out.
All right. Excellent. Dude, an L. These were fun. You didn't look it up? Come on. You didn't expect me to just quiz you on the measurements?
I just all looked right, it up.
Well, okay. So anyways...
I figured it would come up, but yeah. 45 inches.
No, hold on. No. All right, this doesn't sound impressive. You can look this up in 5 minutes, but not in 30 seconds, which Clifford just proved, because that's wrong. So L, it gets its name from elbow, because it's elbow to fingertip is the length, okay? Hmm. And apparently that's the size of the cubit. So like when you read... Exodus, and God's telling Moses how he wants his Ark of the Covenant and his tent. Oh, and Noah's Ark. Everything's measured in cubits, and everybody's just kind of asked, what the hell is a cubit? Because we don't know. But apparently that's what it is. Elbow to fingertip. So, obviously this is kind of a dumb measurement, because, everybody's elbow to fingertip length is different, right?
Mm-hmm. But that's like foot, right?
No. I think standardized, it's like 18 inches. It's definitely longer than a foot. Mine's probably more like... What's mine? Mine's pretty close to 18 inches. It's definitely... This is longer than a foot.
20 inches?
Look at this. This is... Yeah, it's... I mean, it's... A foot would be to, like, where my shirt ends.
No. I'm saying that, like, in the same way that the English imperial measurement of foot originated from...
Oh, yeah.
The literal foot, which everyone has different sized feet. It's like, where'd you come up
right,
with that?
Okay, so 18 inches, okay, that's kind of what Wikipedia then, you know, established, because Wikipedia is not a qualified source on this, because there was no Wikipedia when people used L's. By the time we invented Wikipedia, L's mm-hmm. were out of fashion. But
the etymology of the word, it means arm.
Right. Well, yeah, elbow, you know, L.
Elbow is Old English for arm bent, mm-hmm. like bow mm-hmm. in a river, L, arm. So.
Interesting. Okay, all right, but anyways, back to the task at hand. I think L was actually an obvious choice of measurement in this situation, because you know what I guess? I bet you rope was measured in L's because you would wind it around your arm and you would count how many times it winds around. But if you do this math, 18 inches times 30 L's, because that's what it says in the book, that's going to get you 540 inches. If you divide that by 12 inches to get this into feet, that's 45 feet of rope. Divided by 6 feet, that only gives you 7.5 fathoms, which they said this thing's 18 fathoms. Mm. So what I think is he was using the – if you look at Wikipedia, they have other measurements for it. There's one that's like 37 inches. I think that would make sense because you probably double wrap it, you know, like down and up. Is 1L. You know, you go down the length of your hands holding it, you go down the length to your around your elbow, and then back up could be 1L.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
that would get you the 36, which you would double the distance. So that comes close to 30 fathoms because it would be like 15 fathoms.
Well, hold on. I have a bone to pick. How he had 30 L's?
No, he said it's 30 L's. Yeah.
Okay. Whatever this original definition was that I read off that said typically about 45 inches, which doesn't jive with the elbow to fingertip measurement, but apparently this was understood as a textile measurement of about 45 inches, which whatever definition I'm reading says it was at the equivalent of 6 hand breadths. So I'm thinking that's hand lengths or hand widths. Anyways, 45 inches with the math you just described, times 30 divided by 12 divided by 6 gives you 18.75 fathoms. So that would be perfectly just longer than the height of what Frodo thought the cliff was, right? So maybe Tolkien was actually using that 45 inch assumption.
Right? Yeah, potentially, yeah. Besides that, Frodo said, oh, that might just be enough. So maybe it's my 37 inches, and he's just going to hope 15 gets him.
Anyways, yeah. I it is curious if Tolkien used this word because he knew it was an Old English word, or because at the time he was growing up in Britain, a fabric store legitimately sold things in elves.
Oh, wait, hold on. Hold on, here we go. I forgot this is the last notes to it, too. If you simply go to the Wikipedia page on elves, you will go down beyond the measurement lengths, and then you'll see in literature, and it says, elves are used for measuring the length of rope in J.R.R. Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings. Also, though, second line, this probably proves that you're right. In the epic poem Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, which I think Tolkien translated, the Green Knight's axe head was an L, 45 inches wide. So, yeah, maybe you're right with the 45.
Yeah, it doesn't say why it is, but it says it's a yard and a quarter in the tailoring business.
A yard and a quarter. Oh. Does rope... Well, wait. Anyways. What's the name for... Ropes don't fall under tailoring, right?
Not really.
Okay.
No.
Yeah. That's what I thought.
I mean, it's fabric. Tailors aren't doing rope, but it's fabric. It's like cord. I don't know. So maybe it could be similar to fabric.
Okay.
But yeah, it's a good question.
Okay. Yeah, so that was our conversation about them getting down the cliff. All right. Okay, so when they get down,
it's important to know exactly how big that cliff was.
Okay, so they get down, and at some point, by this point, the stars and the moon are already out. Now, notable, despite all these land descriptions looking really bleak, the stars still looked beautiful, which is good. Mm. We have that comfort. Let's keep tabs on that as we go through.
Okay.
So, anyways, so they attempt to hike at night for at least a little bit, but the ground is still unsafe with many fissures. What's a fissure?
Fissure, like little cracks, crevasses in the rock.
Right? But is it like big enough for your foot to just get stuck and you like your ankle gets stuck?
I don't know if it has a specific dimension associated with it, but yeah, I could imagine at least enough to twist an ankle or kind of get your whole like post hole, get your whole
leg like
in,
hook you or something.
Possibly big enough to fall completely into.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So anyways, so instead of doing that, they decide to walk along the skirts of the Emmemuil where there aren't any yet, I guess. So they sit down. They're both about to fall asleep when all of a sudden they see coming down the cliff. And I think this is not the same spot where they climbed from.
Yeah, it's further
right, because this one's smoother, I think, from the details that we're going to read. But what do you know? Mm-hmm. Who's walking down?
Gollum.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Walking, but more crawling.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
They describe him being kind of.
Oh, don't like spoil. Well, let's read about it a little bit because these are good descriptions. Okay.
Down the face of a precipice, sheer and almost smooth, it seemed in the pale moonlight. A small black shape was moving with its thin limbs splayed out. Maybe its soft, clinging hands and toes were finding crevices and holds that no hobbit could ever have seen or used. But it looked as if it was just creeping down on sticky pads, like some large prowling thing of insect kind. And it was coming down head first, as if it was smelling its way. Now and again it lifted its head slowly, turning it right back on its long, skinny neck, and the hobbits caught a glimpse of two small, pale, gleaming lights, its eyes that blinked at the moon for a moment, and then were lidded quickly again.
The black crawling shape was now 3/4 of the way down, and perhaps 50 feet or less above the cliff's foot. Crouching stone still in the shadow of a large boulder, the hobbits watched him. He seemed to have come to a difficult passage, or to be troubled about something. They could hear him snuffling, and now and again there was a harsh hiss of breath that sounded like a curse. He lifted his head, and they thought they heard him spit. Then he moved on again. Now they could hear his voice creaking and whistling.
He was getting lower now, and the hisses became sharper and clearer.
Where is it? Where is it? My precious, my precious. It's ours, it is, and we wants it. The thieves, the thieves, the filthy little thieves. Where are they with my precious? Curse them, we hates them.
At last, he was no more than a dozen feet from the ground, right above their heads. From that point, there was a sheer drop, for the cliff was slightly undercut, and even Gollum could not find a hold of any kind. He seemed to be trying to twist around, so as to go legs first, when suddenly, with a shrill, whistling shriek, he fell. As he did so, he curled his legs and arms up round him, like a spider whose descending thread is snapped. Sam was out of his hiding in a flash, and crossed the space between him and the cliff foot in a couple of leaps. Before Gollum could get up, he was on top of him. But he found Gollum more than he bargained for, even taking like that, suddenly, off his guard after a fall. Before Sam could get a hold, long legs and arms wound round him, pinning his arms, and a clinging grip, soft but horribly strong, was squeezing him like slowly tightening cords. Clammy fingers were feeling for his throat. Then sharp teeth bit into his shoulder. All he could do was to butt his hard round head sideways into the creature's face. Gollum hissed and spat, but he did not let go. Things would have gone ill with Sam if he had been alone, but Frodo sprang up and drew Sting from its sheath. With his left hand, he drew back Gollum's head by his thin, lank hair, stretching his long neck and forcing his pale, venomous eyes to stare up at the sky.
"Let go, Gollum," he said. "This is Sting. You have seen it before, once upon a time. Let go, or you will feel it this time. I'll cut your throat." Okay, and then from there, he lets Sam go. Thoughts? I thought the movie did a good job with those things.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. Also, great descriptions here.
Yep.
Gollum's just such a creepy little... I don't know how to describe him. He's Gollum. The movie has created like a Gollum exists in like popular imagination in a way that like few other characters do, I think.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I guess most Lord of the Rings characters do, but Gollum is just like, he's Gollum. There's nothing quite like him.
Well, Clifford, I may or may not have to cut this out. Maybe I'll just bleep all this stuff, but we're going to do a special in March where we'll do a bracket of the best Tolkien character and not like best created character, not our favorites or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a good chance Gollum's going to win overall, in my opinion.
Oh man.
So, I mean, we'll see. I don't know. Like, he is very, 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 very well crafted. So
yes. Well crafted, well described. I get chills reading about him.
Yeah.
Creeping along the cliff face, falling off, and then, I don't know, it's so vivid in my mind.
I mean, the insect spider descriptions is like, oh, this is a good idea, you know? Very creepy.
Yeah, something about the description of the Gollum, I find those among the easiest passages to envision when I'm reading of almost any part of the book.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just like so detestable, but so present.
Kind of creepy or maybe sad right off the bat that he falls down, you know, and he fell at least a dozen feet, right? And Sam's on him immediately, but Gollum just reflexes quickly, is defending himself.
Yeah, it does like a quick judo thing and just flips him over and is like about to strangle him.
Right, but if you've read the rest of the chapter, it's kind of sad a little bit that this thing's been living out in the wild so long that he has such quick reflexes, and he's like he can never let his guard down. Like, even in this situation, he's immediately ready, you know, to defend himself, right? Which is like good. But then also, just imagine a normal human if they fell.
Yeah, you mean he's like savage. Yeah. He's like a wild creature.
Yeah, can never have peace or relax or something.
Right,
you know, like right off the bat, we can kind of tell that.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point.
All right, so let's get into it. Let's get this conversation going. I'll take Gollum this episode, but I'm not committing to him for this whole book. Okay.
Okay, fine.
you got Frodo, and I'll take Sam too. Don't hurt us. Don't let them hurt us, precious. They won't hurt us, will they? Nice little hobbitses. We didn't mean no harm, but they jumped on us like cats on poor mice. They did, precious. And we're so lonely, Gollum. We'll be nice to them, very nice, if they'll be nice to us, won't we? Yes, yes.
Well, what's to be done with it, said Sam. Tie it up so as it can't come sneaking after us no more, I say.
But that would kill us, whimpered Gollum. Cruel little hobbitses. Tie us up in the cold, hard lands and leave us? Gollum, Gollum. Sobs welled up in his gobbling throat.
No, said Frodo. If we kill him, we must kill him outright. But we can't do that, not as things are. Poor wretch, he has done us no harm.
Oh, hasn't he, said Sam, rubbing his shoulder. Anyway, he meant to, and he means to, I'll warrant. Throttle us in our sleep, that's his plan.
I dare say, said Frodo. But what he means to do is another matter. He paused for a while and thought. Gollum lay still, but stopped whimpering. Sam stood glowering over him. It seemed to Frodo that he heard, quite plainly but far off, voices out of the past. What a pity Bilbo did not stab the vile creature when he had a chance. Pity? It was pity that stayed his hand. Pity and mercy, not to strike without need. I do not feel any pity for Gollum. He deserves death. Deserves death, I dare say he does. Many that live deserve death, and some died that deserve life. Can you give that to them? Then be not too eager to deal out death in the name of justice, fearing for your own safety. Even the wise cannot see all ends. Very well, he answered aloud, lowering his sword. But still I am afraid, and yet, as you see, I will not touch the creature. For now that I see him, I do pity him.
All right, what are we thinking back to? What was that quote from that you read?
That was Gandalf, but I can't place where it was. Was it from the very beginning? When Gandalf was speaking with Frodo about the history of the ring?
Yeah, in Bag End.
Or was it later on?
No, in Bag End.
Yeah. Back at Bag End.
Yeah, yeah.
All right.
The movie puts it in Moria, but that's just wrong.
Anyways, that's the... We mentioned it then to pay attention to it. That was Gandalf dropping the... I feel like one of the strongest, or at least most clear chunks of morality or something.
Yeah.
In the book, handing it over to Frodo and just like, you can't kill this creature just because you don't like him or you think that he's bad. Who are you to judge?
Well, so both parts remind us that in The Hobbit, Bilbo had the chance to kill Gollum and he didn't because he felt pity for him, which is what sparked this conversation between Frodo and Gandalf in Bag End.
Right.
And at the time, Frodo just thought that was a foreign concept. He didn't quite get what was up with Bilbo, and he was revolted by the thought that Gollum's kind of might have used to been some sort of hobbit, and he just didn't understand it at all. But then all of a sudden, within a page of meeting this guy, finally, after, you know, he'd been lurking after him for months, he meets him, he sees him right away, and he's just, oh, damn. Yeah, I do feel bad for him. It's kind of crazy.
Which, when you frame it that way, it's like, well, you know, what if Gollum has this, he's got this kind of devilish or Saruman-like ability to just, like, sway people. You know, you look at him too long and he, like, deceives you and he makes you pity him and he immediately starts groveling and, oh, feel bad for me, I'm so weak and sad and, you know, I can't do anything. How could you hurt me? How could you hurt me? But it's all just like you can see right through it because you know that he's a terrible little creature.
No, but
part of me thinks it's like, okay, he's just deceptive, and as soon as Frodo's exposed to him, he like falls into this deceit. But then the other part of me is like, no, the second Frodo sees him, he sees like whatever glimmer of humanity is left in this creature. He sees that and is like, I can't do this. I can't deliberately torture or kill this creature who, like, ultimately I see had a soul or has a soul, something like that.
Yeah, it's absolutely the second thing that you said, because keep in mind, too, he literally quotes the conversation with Gandalf. So, I mean, if Gandalf knew this guy had some sort of magical voice like Saruman, Frodo would have been aware of it and he wouldn't have been falling for it. Plus, when we read the rest of the chapter, just reaffirms the second view here that he sees the humanity in him. He sees him how like a really good person would see Gollum's soul here, you know, even though he's definitely, we can already kind of tell, that he's twisted and screwed up and all sorts of problems with him. But
Yeah, I guess I mean, like, clearly if, you know, what Gandalf said earlier is, like, obvious foreshadowing, and no way is it a good idea to, like, walk back on something Gandalf warned you about.
Yeah.
That's clear throughout the books. That's, like, a rule almost. I'm just thinking in, like, a parallel situation. Like, let's say we didn't have these specific words from Gandalf, and instead we had some bit of wisdom from Strider that sounded pretty good when he said it. That was like, you know, you never know who you can trust, or something kind of like, just be wary,
yeah,
because everyone's trying to deceive you. And then we met Gollum, and those were the words that Frodo remembered. I'm just thinking, like, Frodo could look at this and be like, you know what? No, like, my gut instinct was that this creature needs to die or whatever. And now here I am pitying him now that I've been, like, wooed by him, sort of.
Yeah,
I don't know. I'm not saying that that's what happens in the book at any point. I just feel like it's some part of me feels like that could easily happen.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes any sense. Nevertheless, this little interaction here and Frodo's reaction is critical. We'll talk about it more, I'm sure, but it kind of sets the tone, I think, for a huge part of the rest of the book.
For sure.
Okay, so I'll start with Colin. Yes, wretched are we, precious, he whined. Misery, misery, hobbits won't kill us, nice hobbits.
No, we won't, said Frodo, but we won't let you go either. You're full of wickedness and mischief, Gollum. You will have to come with us, that's all, while we keep an eye on you. But you must help us, if you can. One good turn deserves another.
Yes, yes indeed, said Gollum, sitting up. Nice hobbits. We will come with them. Find them safe paths in the dark. Yes, we will. And where are we going in these cold, hard lands? We wonders. Yes, we wonders. He looked up at them, and a faint light of cunning and eagerness flickered for a second in his pale, blinking eyes.
Sam scowled at him and sucked his teeth, but he seemed to sense that there was something odd about his master's mood, and that the matter was beyond argument. All the same, he was amazed at Frodo's reply. Frodo looked straight into Gollum's eyes, which flinched and twisted away. You know that, or you guess well enough, Smeagol, he said, quietly and sternly. We're going to Mordor, of course, and you know the way there, I believe.
Ah, yes, said Gollum, covering his ears with his hands, as if such frankness in the open speaking of names hurt him. We guessed, yes, we guessed, he whispered, but we didn't want them to go, did we? No, precious, not the nice hobbits. Ashes, ashes, and dust, and thirst there is, and pits, 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 and orcs, thousands of orcses. Nice hobbits mustn't go those places.
So you've been there, Frodo insisted, and you're being drawn back there, aren't you?
Yes, yes, no, shrieked Gollum. Once, by accident wasn't it, precious? Yes, by accident. But we won't go back. No, no. Then suddenly his voice and language changed, and he sobbed in his throat and spoke, but not to them. Leave me alone, Gollum. You hurt me. My poor hands, Gollum. I don't want to go back. I can't find it. I am tired. We can't find it. Gollum, Gollum. No, nowhere. They're always awake. Dwarves, men, and elves. Terrible elves with bright eyes. I can't find it. Ah! He got up and clenched his long hands with his bony, fleshless knot, shaking it towards the east. He won't. He cried, not for you. Then he collapsed again. Gollum, Gollum, he whimpered with his face on the ground. Don't look at us. Go away. Go to sleep.
He will not go away or go to sleep at your command, Smeagol, said Frodo. But if you really wish to be free of him again, then you must help me. And that, I fear, means finding us a path towards him. But you need not go all the way, not beyond the gates of his land.
Gollum sat up and looked at him under his eyelids. He's over there, he cackled. Always there. Orcs will take you all the way. Easy to find orcs east of the river. Don't ask Smeagol. Poor, poor Smeagol. He went away long ago. They took his precious, and he's lost now.
Perhaps we'll find him again if you come with us, said Frodo.
No, no, never. He's lost his precious, said Gollum.
Get up, said Frodo. Gollum stood up and backed away from the cliff. Now, said Frodo, can you find a path easier by day or by night? We're tired, but if you choose the night, we'll start tonight.
The big lights hurts our eyes, they do, Gollum whined. Not under the white face, not yet. It will go behind the hills soon, yes. Rest a bit first, nice hobbits.
Then sit down, said Frodo, and don't move.
Okay, thoughts there, or should we just keep going?
I mean, yeah, that sets the stage for this book. Frodo has Well, I mean, there's a few key things to know. Plot-wise, Frodo has now kind of sworn Gollum to be their leader, their pathfinder. Well,
guide, Gollum, not the leader.
okay. Their guide through the landscape. Notably, Frodo is always addressing him as Smeagol and not Gollum. And then Gollum is referring to himself as Gollum. And we got a little bit of this kind of like multiple personality
right.
schizophrenia thing going on, where Gollum was referring to himself as Gollum or referring to Gollum as a third person, right?
The when he's saying I think that's the Smeagol part of him. Mm-hmm. And then when he's saying we and he's more harsh and kind of more evil, I think that's the ring / Sauron / Precious side.
Interesting.
Of,
okay.
I think.
Yeah. No, you're right, because the one part where he goes to first person and doesn't refer to himself in the royal we is when he seems to be talking to Gollum, and he says, "Leave me alone, Gollum. You hurt me."
Right.
So that's important to keep an eye on as we go forwards.
Yeah. Okay, so from there, they sit down with Gollum to rest, or Smeagol to rest, whichever you want to call him now. There's a funny line, though. There was no need for any arrangements by word. They knew that they must not sleep for a moment. So then Frodo and Sam, I think they kind of give each other a look. They purposely both close their eyes at the same time. Gollum immediately tries to bolt, mm-hmm. but then they're quick and they jump on him. I don't know. That kind of seems like that might be some prisoner trick or something in like World War I. You know, trench, maybe.
Perhaps.
I was just guessing, but
perhaps
fishing for where you get it, but that just might be common enough that he could come up with that idea.
Well, it's also clear, like they tried to catch him once and they saw how fierce he was, and I think even though he's talking the talk, they have no reason to believe that he's gonna do anything that they say at the moment, right?
Right, absolutely. So. Yeah. Especially since he was the one that offered, like, oh, you guys should go sleep, you know? Just rest a little bit, right. And then we'll go on. When you're ready, you know?
Right.
Okay, so then at this point, Frodo decides that we should just tie a rope around his ankle so he can't get away. But when they do, Gollum's immediately screaming, and he's complaining and everything, and Frodo looks at the knot, and it's a very loose knot, and so he just says basically, like, what the hell's the matter with you? Mm-hmm. Like, what's going on here? And Gollum says, it hurts us. It hurts us, hiss Gollum. It freezes. It bites. Elves twisted it. Curse them. Nasty, cruel hobbits. That's why we tries to escape. Of course. Of course it is, Precious. We guessed it was the cruel hobbits. They visited elves. Fierce elves with bright eyes. Take it off us. It hurts us.
No, I will not take it off you, said Frodo. Not unless, he paused a moment and thought, not unless there is any promise you can make that I can trust.
We will swear to do what he wants. Yes, said Gollum, still twisting and grappling at his ankle. It hurts us.
Swear, said Frodo.
Smeagol, said Gollum, suddenly and clearly, opening his eyes wide and staring at Frodo with a strange light. Smeagol will swear on the precious.
Frodo drew himself up, and again Sam was startled by his words in his stern voice. On the precious? How dare you, he said. Think, one ring to rule them all, and in the darkness bind them. Would you commit your promise to that, Smeagol? It will hold you, but it is more treacherous than you are. It may twist your words. Beware.
Gollum cowered. On the precious, he repeated.
And what would you swear? Asked Frodo.
To be very, very good, said Gollum. Then crawling to Frodo's feet, he groveled before him, whispering hoarsely. A shudder ran over him, as if the words shook his very bones with fear. Smeagol will swear never, never to let him have it. Never. Smeagol will save it. But he must swear on the precious.
No, not on it, said Frodo, looking at him with stern pity. All you wish is to see it and touch it, if you can, though you know it would drive you mad. Not on it. Swear by it, if you will, for you know where it is. Yes, you know, Smeagol, it is before you. For a moment it appeared to Sam that his master had grown and Gollum had shrunk. A tall, stern shadow, a mighty lord who hid his brightness in gray cloud, and at his feet a little whining dog. Yet the two were in some way akin and not alien. They could reach one another's minds. Gollum raised himself and began pawing at Frodo, fawning at his knees. Down, down, said Frodo. Now speak your promise.
We promises. Yes, I promise, said Gollum. I will serve the master of the precious. Good master. Good Smeagol. Gollum. He suddenly began to weep and bite at his ankle. All right, so that was pretty big. At this point, they free him, and this is going to be about the end of the chapter. So mm-hmm. What do we think of that?
this is, well, proving out the previous exchange we just had, where now he has to be really held to it. But this seemed big, like, there's, with the multiple personality thing going on,
yeah.
If you caught, Smeagol is the one swearing on the Precious, or swearing by it.
Right.
And then...
But that, I don't think that means, like, Precious, like, his name, you know, the Gollum part of him might be called... He would probably refer to that as Precious, but when he says Precious here, he means, I think, the physical ring itself.
Right, right.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Frodo makes, kind of, I guess, adds a smart clause to their contract, you might say, and is like, no. You're not swearing on it, you're swearing by it, which sounds semantic, but the point of that little exchange was to say, this is not about the ring. Making this promise with the intent of, like, the ring being the only thing here. You're serving whoever has the ring, right? Meaning, you're serving me.
Yeah, I think it makes sense. I don't know. I always get confused by that part, honestly.
Yeah, I don't know the exact significance of on it versus by it. I don't know that I could specify, like, when people say they swear on something or they swear by something. But that it's clearly meaning Frodo saying... The power of the ring is binding you, but the ring is not your master. I'm your master.
Yeah, by it is like, this thing's powerful.
The ring is like the guarantee or something.
Yeah,
on the contract.
Guarantee or you know, like the tool to guarantee it when you say yeah, buy. Yeah. Whereas right. on is like, yes, this is the end all be all, most important thing, and it's right. That's not what it should be. Right. I think. Yeah. What about how the rope actually hurts him? Like, even though it was a pretty loose knot.
Well, it seems clear it's because the elves made it, right?
Right, okay.
So the elves made is, like, glowing with goodness. And just like it glows, the swords glow blue when orcs are around. The fabric of the elves is burning Smeagol's skin.
Well, yeah, and so that's more of a, you know, says something about Gollum, how you must be pretty evil if just touching the elves' good rope, you know, that with their powers and it hurts him so bad.
right. But on the other hand, if the sunlight hurts him, you know, he's already so transformed that he's clearly become something else.
Yeah. What'd you think of the part where Frodo lords over Gollum and kind of dominates him? Hey, yeah, this is going to hold you.
Yeah.
Sam was impressed by it.
Impressive. But I mean, it's intriguing in multiple ways because it's like, okay, impressive. Frodo's like coming into his own. He's really taking charge of the situation. And
is that Frodo on his own?
Well, so he's showing Gollum who's boss. Like, nice. This is good character development, maybe. Uh-huh. Or it's like, oh, you know, he's becoming more powerful and more power hungry because of the ring. And he's like. Right. It's a very small dosage of, like, the conquering nature of the ring. Like, it wants to conquer things. And Frodo's nice to Sam, perhaps, but he's, like, he just conquered Gollum, basically.
Well, they said that paragraph was from Sam's perspective, how it looks like Frodo stood tall and stern, you know, like a mighty lord. I mean, that's Sam looking at it, and he's looking at Frodo, super powerful with the ring, versus Gollum, who's already a slave to the ring and now just being dominated by him right there. So, yeah, I think this is... I mean, we read those opening quotes about Frodo's judgment and stuff, and I'd say Frodo did a pretty good job this chapter figuring out what to do or discerning what to do.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there, when he's commanding Gollum, the ring's definitely part of that equation.
Right. A little bit of confidence maybe is good for him, but it's clearly going in the wrong direction.
Right. Yeah, so at this point, that's about the end of the chapter. Besides that, they take off the rope, and then there's that good paragraph about what Sam kind of thinks of all this, and then the... chapter kind of just ends with Gollum preparing to take him through the marshes. But do you want to read what Sam said there?
Sure. At once Gollum got up and began prancing about like a whipped cur whose master has patted it. From that moment, a change, which lasted for some time, came over him. He spoke with less hissing and whining, and he spoke to his companions direct, not to his precious self. He would cringe and flinch if they stepped near him or made any sudden movement, and he avoided the touch of their elven cloaks. But he was friendly, and indeed pitifully anxious to please. He would cackle with laughter and caper if any jest was made, or even if Frodo spoke kindly to him, and weep if Frodo rebuked him. Sam said little to him of any sort. He suspected him more deeply than ever, and if possible, liked the new Gollum, the Smeagol, less than the old.
Kind of weird.
Yeah, I mean, this fits in with what I was saying earlier with these two different things that I think when Frodo first sees Gollum coming after they capture him, and he's remembering Gandalf's words. This is the other side of it, where there's this like saccharine, deceptive nature going on now, and Sam dislikes that.
Well, right, Sam dislikes that. That's what Sam feels.
Before it was like clear, okay, and any enemy's an enemy, but now we've got a traitor in our midst, pretty much.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the difference, though, because Sam, he's not as, he hasn't discussed these kinds of matters, like the whole pity, you know, conversation between Frodo and Gandalf. Actually, Sam was probably, might have been listening in by that point, but who knows? Yeah, I don't know, he doesn't have that much experience with the, you know, who knows how that kind of thing hits. To see, you know, all of a sudden, I mean, Frodo wasn't expecting it, but all of a sudden you just saw, you know, kind of Gollum's soul, and Sam just didn't.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think we'll see how it plays out, but Sam remains super pragmatic to the point of, like, he maybe didn't.
Well, Frodo's been pragmatic too, though, because he's got a guy. They need somebody to help.
He did some good problem solving in this episode, but through it all, Sam remains, like, I don't know, driven. And maybe shortfall in that he can't see Gollum's humanity the way that Frodo can. Like, he's not willing to kind of extend that that branch or empathy or whatever. But he's like, he keeps his eye on the prize the whole time. Whereas Frodo, I think, will be a little bit more of a loose cannon. But we'll have to wait and see where it goes.
We will. All right, Clifford.
All good.
Cool. All right, Clifford, we're back for 2021.
Happy New Year, Patrick.
Happy New Year to you as well. Are you sad to see 2020 go?
Not really. I don't think anyone is.
How was your Christmas or other holidays, if applicable?
It was actually pretty nice. I was braced for it to be kind of a strange, awkward holiday, but it ended up being a pleasant one. Got to see Hazel's family and my family. Did some hiking out here in San Francisco. We had really nice weather.
Nice.
And all around pretty pleasant.
Now
back on the grind, but I feel rejuvenated. Yeah. How was your holiday?
It was pretty excellent. Went to Chicago for 2 weeks. It was super fun. Even though obviously most stuff's locked down, so it was pretty kind of low key, but it was fun the whole time. Mm-hmm. Dude, I almost seriously during that time, I really almost forgot that we do a token podcast. It was awesome. Now, caveat, the first couple days I was hardcore editing our super long True Myth special part one, and that was a grind to get that out by Christmas Eve. As soon as that was done, I totally forgot that I do a token podcast. Slowly edited like maybe one episode over the course of 4 days. I got like 20 minutes done, which is nothing. Mm-hmm. But I mean, yeah, it was pretty relaxing. And then I got back here and it's like, oh, I haven't even read the chapter. Now, luckily for the chapter that we're going to do, spoiler, I don't have that much responsibility.
Ooh. Brace yourselves.
So you can tell what day that chapter was recorded, even though this we're doing this what, January 5th? Yeah So actually, you know, Christmas really isn't over yet, Clifford. This is only the 11th day of Christmas.
Tomorrow's the Epiphany.
I've been working hardcore over the past couple of years to extend playing Christmas music past the day.
So any success?
I got to the third this year, which is an incremental improvement of maybe a day or two.
So what, yesterday you were just like, I can't do it anymore?
No, yesterday I got back to work and I forgot to listen to Christmas music. Okay. No, basically, going back to work kind of kills the Christmas mood.
Uh-huh. No doubt about it.
When I haven't been at work for 2 weeks, yeah, that'll do it. Yeah. Dude, did you get any cool presents?
Actually, I feel pretty darn spoiled. We got a hand-me-down espresso machine from Hazel's dad and a grinder, so I'm making some fancy coffee at home now. Yeah. How about you?
Dude, I also feel spoiled. I got so much stuff that... Actually, they read me really well. This was all stuff I was going to order, but nice. Then they got it for me. Now, the problem was I didn't want to take all this stuff back on the plane, which is why I was going to order myself and not ask for it.
Uh-huh.
But I did get a pizza stone. So pizza, it's the real deal, starts this weekend because I always give pizza up for lunch. So we don't have much time. We got a small window to get as much pizza expertise as I can. Yeah. So I got that. Exciting. I got one of those AeroPresses that I showed you when you were here. You
know, yeah,
I got
that. Nice.
I got that for home. So that when I go home, I can just have that.
But that you can travel with that really easily, right?
I could, but...
You didn't want to.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, you've got one of your
I could. Okay. I could. There's no excuse. And then got some
wait, how did you fly with the pizza stone?
Excellent question, Clifford. Because the box did not fit in my suitcase. I had to unpack the pizza stone. And then... It's a pretty sturdy thing, but I feel like if like a bodybuilder took it, they could crack it over their knee. You know, you know what I mean?
Because yeah, it's a stone. It's like
ceramic or whatever. Maybe maybe I'm off. Anyways, I decided I'm going to pack it in the middle of my clothes so that the clothes all provide a cushion for it. Like I wasn't just gonna put it on top or put it on bottom. It's like I'll have it in the middle, and it just barely fit in the middle of all the clothes in the suitcase. So that's how I got it.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I did not bring the pizza cutter because I was scared that the airport would not let it through.
Oh yeah,
so
definitely not.
So alas, I don't have a pizza cutter. Yeah. Oh, and also, dude, you gotta see this. Where is it? Oh my gosh, nobody else can see this. But look at this.
Ooh, nice cycling cap,
dude. This is the quintessential '90s cycling look. Mappe cycling cap for anybody wondering. This is
What is Mappe? Is that a team?
That was a team. They were an Italian chemical sponsor, but the team was mostly Belgian. Perfect combination, obviously. This is the loudest. For anybody that's looking this up right now, this is the loudest hat of all time, but this is one that worked. There's lots of jerseys from the 90s that were hideous and loud and didn't work. This one did, and it was awesome, especially when they went 1-2-3 at Paris-Roubaix. Obviously, I didn't watch that live because I was like 5 and I didn't know what cycling was.
You know,
I didn't know cycling was a sport.
When you put that on, I was like, Mappe, like that looks familiar. They make grout that we specify sometimes in architecture to go between tiles, like in someone's fancy shower.
Mm,
they make grout, tile grout in like every possible color. But it's like a grout company. I don't know. It's kind of funny that they're on a cycling cap.
Yeah, it makes no sense why they sponsor a cycling team besides I think the owner likes cycling. Italian way. Yeah, the Italian owner liked cycling, so I think he sponsored a team. That's usually how it goes.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. This was I feel like we've gone long enough. Yeah, okay. This is about 8 minutes, so yeah. Anything else?
No, that's it.
Yeah, this is episode one. Yeah, yep. All right, and we'll be back soon with the next one. We're going to just roll it off. We've almost got most of book four done already, so get ready. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Okay, sounds good. Thanks, y'all.